Welcome to Theatre Voice, the V&A's archive of conversations with leading theatre practitioners. I'm Tim Banno, I'm the editor of Theatre Voice. Sir Tim Rice is one of the most celebrated lyricists in musical theatre and film history. Although he wanted to be a pop star, he was led astray when he met Andrew Lloyd Webber in the late 1960s and they began to write musicals, revitalising the sometimes rather tired world of musical theatre by infusing it with pop and rock sounds. Their first hit was Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, followed by Jesus Christ Superstar, and then their magnum opus, Evita. Even though the pair stopped working together many decades ago, those musicals have never gone away, with frequent revivals. And in fact, they have actually now reunited to work on some songs for a show that's premiering at Birmingham Rep in November 2025, called Sherlock Holmes and the 12 Days of Christmas. Collaborations with other top songwriters followed for Tim, including Chess, written with Benny and Bjorn from ABBA. But Rice has also worked way beyond the stage. He's written a James Bond theme. He's written a hit for Elvis Presley. And in the 90s, he got scooped up by Disney, where he finished the lyrics for Aladdin after the death of Howard Ashman. His biggest success, though, probably remains The Lion King, which is one of the highest grossing cultural products of all time. Rice is one of those rare artists who's achieved EGOT status, winning an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. He's a knight, he's been inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and he's recently just completed a huge tour of the UK with a show about his life and work called My Life in Musicals, I Know Him So Well. A lifelong cricket fan, I cruelly kept him away from watching the England-India Test match for an hour and began by asking how his show came about.
I've been doing the same sort of thing for charitable functions and at business dinners and all that. And it's really me chatting in between songs and extracts from the shows performed by people who can actually sing. And it always went really well. And I was then asked to do it on some cruise ships. And I wasn't sure whether cruise ships was my scene. So I agreed to do one trial. And I really had a good time. And then I made a film of me chatting, which meant that the cruise ships could put it onto all of their ships. And even if I wasn't there, I was there on film, and the band and the singers that sang the songs would be live on the ship. So that all went really well. And the musical director of my show on the ships was a gentleman called Duncan Waugh, who I'd met before and has done a lot of West End shows as MD. And he said, why don't we do this professionally as a tour and see how it works? And I was a bit hesitant about it, but we did four shows in 2023 and they went well. We didn't give them much publicity, but they went well. I don't think they made any money, but that wasn't the point. Then in 2024, because they went well, we did a pretty hefty tour, about 22 dates. And that was very successful, to my surprise. And we did it again this year with 35 dates, including Scotland and Ireland and Wales, which I'd rather arrogantly hadn't visited on the 2024 tour. And it was terrific. In fact, the Irish dates were probably the best of the lot in that they sold out very quickly. And most of the dates sold out. One or two, you know, weren't completely full, but I would say most of them got to 80, 90%. And we did the Palladium, which was a big success.
Yeah.
And the format is simply, I've got two wonderful male singers, two wonderful female singers, Duncan Waugh and a small band who make a noise like it sounds, you know, the big orchestra. Mm. And we do, by and large, the hits from the shows that people will know. I think if you're going to do 2 hours and expect people to sit through your stuff, you've got to give them songs they know and love,
yep,
or we hope love, or at least like. But I did fling in one or two ones that are slightly unknown for variety. It's a bit like a rock concert, even if someone is brilliant as Elton John, who's got so many hits, he could play for 2 or 3 days without repeating himself. But even with someone like Elton, if they say, and now I'm going to play my new album, people go, oh, because it may well be brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
But if they haven't heard it, they want to hear the hits. And I sometimes thought, I wouldn't mind, you know, not hearing Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. But you've got to give it to the fans. And that one always went down extraordinarily well. They went berserk. But because it was so well performed by Shona Daly, and I was sitting on stage right next to Shona, in the shadows, I hope I wasn't distracting from her performance, but she sang it so well, and she acted it so well, that I thought, actually, it is a good song. I don't mind hearing it again.
Well,
I heard it 33 times on the recent tour.
Yeah, I mean, and it's obviously been in the news again recently. I mean, I doubt there's anyone
Yes.
who's not heard it in the last few weeks.
Oh.
But yeah, it's an extraordinary thing. That kind of resurgence, I mean, you know, call it a resurgence. I don't think those early shows that you did with Andrew ever really went away. But you know, the fact that you can pretty much sell out a 33-date tour, the fact that Evita is playing in the West End at the Palladium, Joseph was there a few years ago, you know, there was a fantastic Jesus Christ Superstar revival. It does feel like it's all happening. The popularity is just there as it ever was. I mean, do you feel like that's been a thing that's been sustained over the years? Do you feel like that's been a thing that's kind of resurged recently?
I think there's a bit of both. I think, without blowing my own trumpet too much, they've always been popular. I mean, shows have always been done all around the world of Superstar Joseph and Evita. And suddenly, there've been great new productions, obviously, of Evita and of Andrew Sunset Boulevard. And there's a very good production of Superstar at the Watermelon in Newbury at the moment. I haven't seen yet, but everybody, I'm booked to go. Everybody says, and that got even better reviews than Evita did. And Joseph goes on forever. And then, of course, I've got the Disney stuff as well, like Lion King, which just keeps on and on and on.
It doesn't it, yeah.
So I've got enough to keep me busy. And all I can say is I'm very grateful. And I'm glad that they keep going at this level before I conk out.
Well, it doesn't look like it's happening anytime soon. So tell me about some of the kind of deeper cuts that you put into the show. What are some of the unexpected numbers that people may be less familiar with?
I'd recently written a pure pop song with Gary Barlow, which nobody would have known. And I just wanted to illustrate that I was aware of people who were a little bit younger than me. It's called A Matter of Love, and it's a really nice song. I also did a song that Elvis recorded, written by me and Andrew, which is quite a funny story. I mean, I think it's quite important to have something interesting to say about each song. When the great Burt Bacharach died in the middle of the last tour, 2024, I had written a couple of songs with Burt, one for a film and one for an album that he recorded very late in his life. And he asked me to do a lyric. And I asked Duncan if we could slip the song in as a tribute to Burt. And Laura sang it so well, without hardly knowing the song. But I mean, she learned it very quickly. So things like that I've sort of slotted in. But it's mainly hits. There've been it's almost 80, 85% hits. I put in Winter's Tale, which was a big hit song, but not many people realised that I had a hand in that song. And for the Palladium, we got the great David Essex to come along and actually perform it.
Oh, really?
So just for fun. And Rob Brydon, I mean, it was also a guest at the Palladium show, as indeed was Lord Lloyd Webber. But Rob Brydon, who's a lovely man and I've got to know pretty well over the years, he's an Elvis fanatic. And the first time I met him, he came up to me and he began singing this song, It's Easy for You, which is not a very well-known song. Elvis recorded it and it came out on the last album he made before he died. But Rob knew it and he sang it so well. I've asked him to sing it on one or two occasions and he did it at the Palladium and it really brought the
Fantastic.
house down.
It's a
And
great
that was a
song,
song people
though.
didn't really know.
It is a fantastic song. And it was the last song on the last album by
Yes.
Elvis, wasn't it? Which is quite an
Yes.
extraordinary thing, really. Yeah. I think that's a beautiful song. I love that one.
Oh, good.
You've done this huge tour. You've written some new songs with Andrew for an upcoming production. What's the balance between new stuff and between sort of revisiting at this stage?
Well, I'm always doing some new stuff, and I've done five out of the six songs we need for this Sherlock Holmes and the 12 Days of Christmas, which I do emphasize is not really a musical. It's a comedy, very funny comedy, which would have worked without songs. But Humphrey Carr, who's currently playing in the National, he has some very good reviews for a play he's playing in at the National. Humphrey is a distinguished writer. He works in LA and television a lot. He's also an actor and a comedian. He's also 6 foot 8, so anything he says, I agree with. He and his writing partner, David Reed, who've written this wonderfully funny play called Sherlock Holmes and the 12 Days of Christmas. And I've been to one or two workshops of it and thought it was great. And he said to me, do you think you might like to put a couple of songs into it? And I said, well, all right, but would it help the show? And he said, well, we can survive without them. And it's very funny, which I agreed with. But he said, it'd be quite nice to have it just sort of Christmassy, because it mentions Christmas, to have a sort of bit of musical flavour. And I said, well, who's going to write the music? And he said, well, why don't you ask your pal Andrew? So I did, and he agreed. And we've done six, we've still got one to finish, six nice little tunes. But it's not like it's, Oklahoma or Evita, but that's fun. I've also just done three songs for a film called Land of Sometimes, an animated feature, which Ewan McGregor recorded his role the other day, and Helena Bonham Carter's in it. So, and I'm keeping my hand in.
God.
And of course, Chess is about to reopen on Broadway. And that's
So
quite
exciting.
exciting. My goodness knows if it'll work this time, because it was a bit of a disaster last time. But Chess has a real cult following in America, and here to a great extent. They just love it. And the show was not successful in 1988, but we think it might have got a better chance this time. And we're slight revamping of the show. And we've got a very well-known Broadway singer called Lea Michele in the lead role. And we needed another song for the second female character, Svetlana. So I'm just literally in the middle of writing a song with Leon and Benny
Oh, wow.
for Svetlana. And if we were on television, I could show it to you.
Oh, my goodness.
That's just a rough take of it. It's a lovely tune. I mean, one of Benny's great moments, I think. And so that could be fun. It could be interesting.
Well, that's interesting because I think last time we spoke, you were talking about the fact that you'd assembled, or someone had assembled, a 12 CD collection of every
Yeah, that
cut
was
of
me. I
Chess that had
assembled
been.
it. It was me.
Surely you're going to have to redo it now. You're going to have to add to it.
Well, Benny lost his. I had 12 box sets, special ones made for the key people on the album. It's really just the it's a souvenir of every outtake and some songs that got rejected. It's actually rather interesting, and a lot of well-known tunes sung with silly lyrics before I wrote the words. And Benny lost his box, I don't know, or nicked by a fan or something. So I did send him all the work. I mean, he didn't get a replacement, all singing, all dancing wooden box. But I was thinking it might be quite a nice thing to market again. I mean, it was done privately. I paid for it. It cost 20 grand to do, and it
Oh,
was done
God,
beautifully by I was helped out by a very dedicated ABBA fan called Dawn Barson, who, I mean, she's now, I hope she won't mind me saying this, but she now must be nearer 60 than 16, which is, I think, when she first heard Chess. And she was absolute fanatic, like a lot of ABBA fans are, but they're not stupid, they're brilliant. They have very intelligent fans. And ABBA, I mean, you must know this, but ABBA are so big still. I mean, if you go to Voyage, have you seen Voyage?
I haven't seen
You
Voyage
must
yet,
go.
but
You must go.
it's
Even if it's
absolutely
just
on.
for the audience. I
But
mean,
also, not to mention Mamma Mia
oh yeah,
and
Mamma
everything
Mia,
else.
of
It's
course.
just the popularity of that and the party version of that and the new film that's coming. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. But I'm very excited about Chess on Broadway. Partly because every time I've seen iterations of it. I'm one of those sort of slightly, chess mega nuts. But the times that I've seen it, it's different each time. The way I think
Yes.
of it is that there's as many versions of chess as there are variations of moves on a chessboard. It's kind of.
Yes, that's probably true. I mean, most of the, I mean, it's frustrating because we never, had we achieved a brilliantly perfect stage show first time round in 1986 after the success of the album, and we obviously hoped that the show, which was a hit in London, it ran for the best part of 3 years and got its money back somehow. We had Elaine and we had Tommy and we had Murray Head. We had a very good cast. But the show was handicapped by the crisis of Michael Bennett getting ill and leaving the show, just before rehearsal started. And in retrospect, what we should have done, no matter what the cost, would have been to say to the cast, terribly sorry, we're going to have to postpone the whole thing by 6 months. But because we had the cast ready to go, I mean, that would have cost us. We would have, of course, paid them for 6 months, even though they wouldn't have done anything. And they could have got other jobs. So we might have had to reassemble it with a different cast. But Trevor Nunn came in and did a very good job with what he was handed. I mean, he was given a cast he hadn't chosen, but they were good. He was given sets he didn't know what they were always for. And So it was a miracle that Trevor got on such a good version in a few weeks, and it was a success. But when it finished, we thought, well, that wasn't the version we wanted. But then when we took it to Broadway, having resolved to do a completely new version of it, we got it really wrong. And a book was brought in, which wasn't necessary. It's an opera, really. I mean, there's a bit of a book in the new Broadway version, but I always like it best when it's just the opera, just sung like an opera. And it's all there, the storyline. And like if you go to an opera, written by Verdi or Puccini, you don't really always hear every word. And if you do, it's probably in the wrong language. So I think chess works best if you're not panicking about every syllable, if you just get the emotion. I mean, some crackingly good songs in it. And if somebody's singing Anthem or Heaven Help My Heart or Nobody's Side or whatever, or I Know Him So Well, even if you, I mean, what the song is saying is crystal clear. You don't need to explain it.
Yeah, exactly. I know exactly what you mean. I mean, how different is the new Broadway version going to be? How much has it been kind of adapted and changed?
Well, I'm waiting to sort of to see that there is a totally new book in the sense that there is some dialogue, but all the songs are there except there's something. Oh, it's the story of chess is not in it, which is a pity. But I think it's a kind of conclusion to that thing. And it might well be there in connection with a sort of encore reprise, Not quite sure. I mean, we're in the stage where I'm waiting to find out what it's going to be like. And we've got a crackingly good cast lined up. We start rehearsals quite soon. So it'll open in November 2025. Obviously, some people might be listening to this way after that, and they'll know how it went. So they may be thinking, oh, you got that one wrong, mate. Or they may be thinking, oh, fantastic.
But it's that extraordinary thing of you've done this for X number of years now, let's just say, and it's there's still that level of unpredictability about how a show might go down.
Oh yeah. Well, of course, and I mean, everybody has flops and things. I mean, when you're the wunderkind, and with Superstar, as we came out from nowhere with Superstar, the old guard didn't think we'd hang around. And I didn't think we'd hang around really. But Evita was, I think, the most important show in our career because it really established us as more than one hit wonders. And having done two mega hits, and Joseph then came up from behind on the back of those and turned itself into a West End Broadway type show, and yet retained it being as what it really should be at its best is a school play. So we had three hits, and that was. It's rather hard to get rid of people after that. And then since then, we've both had things that have done really well, and we both had things that have done really badly. And that's par for the course. But I think, they'll look back. It's just like we look back on Rodgers and Hammerstein. This sounds a bit arrogant, but I think people in 50 years' time will look back at, oh, Weber and Rice, yeah, it's not as good as it was in their day. But it probably will be. It'll probably be better. Who knows?
Well, but there's always that attitude, isn't there? But the thing I find exciting as well is that it feels like, similarly with Rodgers and Hammerstein, we're kind of getting to a point where enough time's passed for people to be reinterpreting those shows in very exciting ways, in ways that are slightly blowing the dust off them. Because, I think now when people say Oklahoma, there is a certain kind of sense of baggage that comes with that, of kind of Chewing Straw and Bright Golden Haze on the Meadow and stuff. And actually, there was that West End production which came over from Broadway last year, which was incredibly exciting and made it feel very kind of what it would have felt like at the time, which is very fresh, very politically engaged, and very non-dusty. But it feels like there's something similar happening maybe with shows that you've done. I guess Evita is the big example of that. It's a very different Evita from what people have seen before. This is the Jamie Lloyd one at the Palladium. Presumably you've seen it.
Yes, I have. I mean, it's very clever. If it had been the first ever version of Evita, I'm not sure it would have. People must go to it knowing quite a bit about Ava and Evita, and a lot of people go because they loved it first time round or third time round, whenever they first saw it, and it works because it's a kind of new interpretation of something that you can't really say it's a crap show because it isn't. The basic work is good. A lot of people don't like it, but it's I'm sorry for them, but it's around. So any new interpretation is welcome. And I think this is a it's a fantastic interpretation, literally the word fantastic. But whether or not it would have got the show off to the ground, in 1978, I'm not so sure. I mean, for me, if I'm honest, no one could ever top Elaine doing Ava and David Essex doing Che. They were brilliant, as was Jos Sackland doing Perron. And for me, they got it dead right. I was amazed that something I was working on seemed to be going well. And it was because Elaine, apart from her beautiful voice, she's a fine actress. And she looked the part. She was the right age for it. She was the right size. I mean, Ava was small, but powerful. And she had the same initials, which was extraordinary coincidence. And David Essex, he's my favorite Che by far, because he didn't over push it. He was laid back. And so instead of coming on and going, "Oh, what a circus, oh, what a," I mean, he is, "Oh, what a circus, oh, what," I mean, it was like, he was a really intelligent interpretation of the songs. And then when he got angry on occasions later on in the show, it really hit home. But if you come on the first scene yelling and screaming and saying, "This ghastly woman," then you've got nowhere to go.
Yeah, there's no arc, that there's no sort of narrative progression there. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the thing I've been saying about the Palladium Evita to people who are saying, should I go and see it, is essentially yes, but read the plot first, because
Yes,
in the sense
you're
that you
right.
might do for an opera, because actually, for all of its, it is a spectacular, it's a very clever production, it's a very beautiful production, and some extraordinary performances, but it's quite hard to understand the
No,
lyrics.
absolutely. And especially if you're the words man, you think, are these people getting my brilliant wit and incisive comment? The answer is
Well,
no, but they're having a good time.
yeah, exactly. But I mean, that sort of, I wonder how often that's true in musicals anyway, because it does seem like quite often the lyrics are the things that get swallowed, not least because there's the kind of mad scramble at the end of the tech run to get everything right, and the sound engineers don't have enough time to kind of level everything properly. And so, I mean, have you felt that over the course of a career as a lyricist, that the lyrics sometimes are a little bit forgotten about?
Yes, I think yes. If a piece gets really well known, like Joseph, I mean, everybody seems to know all the words of Joseph. Frankly, you hardly need the cast. Whenever you see Joseph, the audience starts singing along, mums as well as the kids, and to a great extent, The Lion King as well. Yes, sometimes you get a performance when you don't. You think, I'm not quite sure they've got this, but usually they have. And the music tells the story as much as the words, and it's the emotions. It's like when I saw Shona Daly doing Argentina every night on my recent tour. I mean, it made me think about my own song. It was almost as if I hadn't written it. And I thought, yeah, that's an interesting interpretation of it. And I can't really remember when I was writing it all those years ago. What I mean, of course, I can remember what I was trying to say, but there were little nuances which maybe I hadn't intended, or there were some that I had intended and forgotten about. And a good performer will bring that out. I mean, Shona did that really well, as Elaine did back in 1978.
It is strange though, because those lyrics, so many of the lyrics you've written, must have been you sort of sitting in your office at a desk by yourself, and now tens of millions of people around the world can recite them or know them by heart.
I know it is strange. I mean, it just works. And of course, it's famously Andrew and I didn't know, didn't really think it was going to be a single. We thought this is a nice song. It was an important scene, and then the record company said, "This is such a great song. This should be a single." And we thought, "No, you can't have it as a single. Don't crack me, Argentina. What's that going to mean on this record?" When the show wasn't known, Eva Perón wasn't known. And we tried it with one or two other titles, which wrecked the song. It was weird. We actually recorded it with Julie Covington singing it, "It's Only Your Lover Returning," or "All Through My Wild Days" as the title. And it just, the whole song collapsed. It was very, very educational for us. But it went back to "Don't Cry for Me, Argentina," even though out of context, it wouldn't have meant anything to people who hadn't seen the show. There was something about it that it really worked. And I remember one critic, I can't remember his name, but whoever he was not, I'm not a great fan. He said, "Well, it's a terrible song. It's just a string of cliches." But that's exactly what it was. It was
Yes.
not that. It was a scene in which a, very attractive but simultaneously rather dishonest politician was selling herself to a crowd very cleverly. And therefore, it sounds wonderful. Oh, in the crowd, oh, then this is fantastic. And they don't really think too much about what's really going on. And so it was meant to be, I mean, most political cliches, I mean, when you look at Keir Starmer, he always comes up with, whatever he says is usually meaningless because they tend to speak in cliches. They don't, and what they really think is, said in private.
Yes.
And that's, true of all politicians virtually. And it's what they have to do at times as
But
well.
I do find that fascinating, though, that that critic and a lot of other critics since just refuse to accept that that might have been intentional from you.
Yes. Well, it was. I mean, it was really meant to be this fascinating, sexy lady. I mean, I'm sure if I'd been a Descamisados in that square, I would have gone, wow, this is fantastic. Our country is safe, and all that. And she, to be fair to Eva, the original Eva Perón, she probably meant it or believed it. I mean, she might have known in her heart of hearts that, there were people out to get her even then, and that anything she did was going to be difficult. But I think she just thought this is something that could work and I'll make it work. But who knows if she'd not got ill, what would have happened? But I think Perón didn't run. I mean, the country went down the tubes actually under Perón.
That political through line's there in chess as well, obviously,
Yeah.
with the kind of the renewed terrifying tension with Russia. It's very, very ripe time for a chess revival.
It probably is accidentally. It was, I mean, what got me interested in the topic. I'm not particularly a chess fan, the game, although I can play, but not very well. It was fascinating that here were Spassky and Fischer, playing for the World Chess Championship, a Russian and American at the height of the Cold War. And everybody, politicians, they on both sides, they moved in to, try and cash in on it. And they turned it into a big political event. And it was intriguing because the American player, Fischer, was, meant to be our guy if you were in the West, and he was a nasty piece of work. And the Russian guy, Boris Spassky, came over as a really delightful fellow. And he was meant to be an evil commie. In fact, he defected to the West in the end, eventually. But I thought this is a wonderful situation, and throw in love and brilliantly intelligent women as well, and you've got a pretty good basis for a story if you get some good tunes, which Bjorn and Benny certainly provided.
Oh my God, didn't they? They're so fantastic. That score is just incredible. Yeah. So I remember last time I talked to you as well, we talked about that move to Disney. So can you just remind me how did that happen? How did you end up in the embrace of Disney in the 90s?
Disney were going to do the movie of Evita back in 1989, 90, which didn't happen. It happened some years later with Disney had an investment, but they weren't really involved. And I went out to Los Angeles to meet one or two of the Disney heavyweights with the possibility of Evita happening. And while I was there, I met Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg and, big cheeses. And I said I was such a great fan of animated films, which I am, and they just had a big revival with Alan Menken and Howard Ashman, and the songs had been crucial to the great success of Little Mermaid and then Beauty and the Beast, and they were now working on Aladdin, and they were thinking because of the great success of the animated films, which had been a bit quiet in the 70s and the 80s, and indeed the beginning of the 90s. They were thinking of ramping up the number of films they were doing. And they were thinking about doing more than one film at once. And they had this very vague idea about a film about a lion cub, which they said was Hamlet with fur, about a lion cub whose wicked uncle kills the father. And would I be interested if this thing happened? Because they didn't want to go to Howard and Alan again because they were working on Aladdin and they couldn't do two at once. So, and then I got the call. Well, we basically saying we think this film will happen, and I joined the team. I went to Disney and I helped out on one or two other things, like a rather fun Dolly Parton film. It was called Straight Talk. Dolly was a agony aunt, on a radio show, and she gets involved with one of her clients or one of her callers. But I was working on that, and I think I was just advising about songs. I didn't know what I was doing really, but Jeffrey Katzenberg was quite impressed and said, "Well, maybe we'd like to get involved full time with a proper animation movie." So I began meeting with the people who were doing this possible film about a lion cub, and of course, the possible film happened. And I was in Disney, working at Disney regularly in LA for 2 or 3 years, and then the film came out. But just before it was coming out, or maybe a few months, the tragedy of Howard Ashman, the great lyricist who'd worked
Yeah.
with Alan, he died. And he was hoping, it was in the end. I mean, I think he knew his time was limited, but he died in the end, tragically, rather quickly before he finished all his work on Aladdin. And because what I'd done on Lion King so far, Disney were quite pleased with, they put me together with Alan to finish off Aladdin, and that gave me a golden opportunity. I felt rather bad about it because I was taking the place of Howard. And of course, the first song Alan and I wrote was A Whole New World.
Yeah.
That was a number one hit single. It was in America. It was a big smash. It won a Golden Globe. It won the Oscars and everything. It really gave me a bit of clout within the Disney empire. I knew that I was extremely lucky because poor Howard would have won all those awards if, even though he hadn't done the lyric for it before he died, whatever lyric he would have done would have been brilliant, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But that kind of established me a bit with Disney a bit more. They thought, well, he's obviously been able to take the place of Howard. And then, on Lion King was even bigger hit than Aladdin had been. And then there was the show, and then I was asked to do some more stuff for Beauty and the Beast stage show because the poor Howard wasn't there for that. And so I got a whole second life to my career in the 90s and the noughties.
When you started on Aladdin, what were you sort of given? Like, were you given the lyrics that Howard had written?
Yes, I mean, some of the songs had already been recorded. I was given the script. There was no lyric for Whole New World. I'm not even sure whether Alan had even written the tune at that point. And there were several songs that have emerged in the stage version of Aladdin, which Howard did write lyrics for, but they weren't considered right for the film. That's not because they weren't necessarily any good, but the animated film stories keep changing quite drastically because you can boot characters out without their agents complaining because giraffes and hippopotamuses or genies don't have agents. So I got the script, which was pretty well finished by then. I mean, and there were two songs missing, a sort of funny song for Aladdin at the beginning on Aladdin on the Run. And the big ballad, big love ballad, and one or two other little lines here and there. And that's what Howard hadn't done. So, and I met Alan, got on very well with him. And first thing he gave me was this tune. He said, "I think this tune could work." And I'd seen the animation, what they were going to do for that scene, the princess and Aladdin flying around the world on the magic carpet, which is, turned out to be a great bit of animation. And Alan said, "I think this song could be called The World at Your Feet. World at our feet." And I thought, I'm not sure feet is a particularly attractive word for a song, which I'm afraid I still think
I think you're right.
that. And I suggested A Whole New World. I lived with the tune for a couple of days, just Alan playing it on the piano without any words. He was singing, la la la. I just thought this is such a great tune, and Whole New World fitted, perfectly. And I wrote the lyrics quite quickly, and it was recorded very quickly. And it was firstly recorded by Brad Kane and Leah Salonga for the film, and then recorded as a pop commercial record by Peabo Bryson and Regina Bell. And that was the record that went to number one. And it's quite funny because they were always saying, "Well, it's a great song. We'll get George Michael and Barbara Streisand to sing it." And I thought, wow, fantastic. But somehow George and Barbara didn't get around to doing it. But actually, you know what? I mean, obviously, I would have been thrilled if those two great singers had done it. But I was even gladder, if that's a word, when it was done by great singers. Don't get me wrong, Peabo and Regina, fantastic singers. But they weren't automatic mega record sellers. They both had a good following. But the fact that their version went to number one, thanks largely to their great singing, but also it meant that the song was good. Barbara Streisand had made a single Chewing Celery, it would have gone to number one. People would have said, "Oh, yeah, well, Barbara Streisand, Disney got her to do it." And, I mean, I'm slightly exaggerating because I think it is a great song, and
Of course it is.
whoever
I
did
mean, it's endured for all those decades since. I mean, there isn't a person who can't who doesn't know A Whole New World, who can't sing A Whole New World. Have you seen the version of the model Jordan, Katie Price, singing it?
Yes, that was a hit in England. It made the top 10. Peter Andre
Peter Andre and Katie
and
Price.
Katie Price. Yeah, it wasn't terrible. They were in tune. Peter Andre's got a good voice.
Peter Andre does, yes. Let's leave it
Yeah.
at that. It must have been strange, though. I mean, I was interviewing Alan Menken for something fairly recent as well, and he was sort of, remembering that time with Howard. And obviously, they were very close, very dear friends. And you then had to come in and sort of develop a relationship with Alan while he was grieving, essentially. H how was that?
Well, I think the pressures of the film, which was Howard's dream, this film, I think Howard was particularly determined to make it a big hit. I think Alan was felt he owed it to Howard to get on with it. Even though I'd never met Alan, I mean, he obviously been told by Disney, listen, this guy Rice, he's okay, he'll probably deliver. I mean, if I hadn't delivered, they're ruthless. They would have booted me off and got somebody else. I don't think I realized the pressure I was under, which is probably a good thing. But it did work very well with Alan, and we've done a few other things since, quite a lot. It's sort of strange. I mean, I was very lucky to be in the right place at the right time. But there again, I could arrogantly say that Disney were lucky I was around at the right time.
I mean, think about The Lion King as well. That has just never gone away. It's never left the public consciousness for a moment in 20, however long it is, almost 30 years now. I remember you telling a great story about how Elton John came to work on that one. Do you remember this, where you were sitting with Disney and they sort of said, "You can who would you ideally like to compose?"
Yeah, no, they did. They said, "Well, The Lion King looks like it's going to happen, and you're going to do the lyrics. Who would you like to write the music?" And you can't have Alan Menken. And this is before poor Howard had died. They said you can't have Alan Menken because he's working on Aladdin. And who would you like to write the music? And I said Elton John. And they hadn't thought about Elton John because he was probably then considered, a brilliant, great megastar, but in records and concerts. And I said, you won't get him. And they said, oh, we'll get him. And the true story was Elton then rang me up when because I knew him a little bit. I didn't know him very well. But he rang me up and said, what's all this, Disney thing? And I explained, and I said, I just thought it might appeal to you. And he said, I'm really sorry. I'd love to do it. Thank you. He was so charming about it. He said, I'd love to do it. And I'm very grateful to you for suggesting me, but I've got 18 concert tours coming up. I've got two albums to record. I'm doing this, that, and the other. I haven't got time. And the deal's not great. And I thought, fair enough. And I thought I was right. And then I got a call about 2 days later from his manager saying, when do we start? And I thought, ah, oh, he's obviously got a better deal than I have.
Someone has upped the number somewhere.
Yes, but I was so delighted. And I honestly think, I've often said that the greatest favor I did for Disney was to get Elton to do the music, because he brought in, I think, a new clutch of followers, and he just, I mean, there are five principal songs in the film, and they're all different. If I can remember them all now, there's a sort of philosophical song, Circle of Life, which has to be quite dramatic. There's a corny love song, Can You Feel the Love Tonight? There's a child song, I Can't Wait to Be King. There's a villain song, Be Prepared. And then there's a song about a warthog with wind problems, Hakuna Matata. Now, they're all very different. They're all part of the story. They're all very important songs within the story. And Elton had to wrote, I mean, I had to give him the lyrics first. He likes it that way around. And I sent off the lyrics, and he came back every time with a brilliant melody. And they were all different, but yet they all had that Elton John stamp. Circle of Life and Hakuna Matata are, quite a way apart. And
Absolutely.
Hakuna Matata amazed me because he wrote that in about, seemed to me, about 20 minutes. I was there when he was writing it, in a hotel room in Paris. And I thought, well, this is fun. It sounds nice, but it'll fill the scene. But it's almost the most popular song of them
I
all.
know, I know. It's crazy. It's mad. I mean, the talent that man has. Because I've heard that as well from, that he just sits at the piano and just writes them. They just sort of pop out of him. I don't know how that happens, but it's extraordinary.
Well, he says he's genuinely inspired by the lyrics, and if he's got a lyric that he thinks is interesting, he'll just sit at the piano and I mean, I heard him do Circle of Life that way as well. He sits at the piano and he starts singing the words, and gradually, something clearly clicks or fits. And Circle of Life was just amazing hearing it. I mean, he wrote that in about an hour and a half, and it just sort of appeared. I mean, it was always going to be at a certain tempo, and he knew it had to be basically a serious song, and it just worked.
Well, that's the thing that's still overwhelming in the stage show, that you start with that moment and the huge puppets coming down the aisles around you and that overwhelming sound. I mean, I found that incredibly overwhelming when I saw it again recently. Still, I'm not a child any longer and still found it incredibly exciting and overwhelming. The thing that interests me as well is that I remember that kind of going way, 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 way back, and you were working, I think, as a legal clerk when you met Andrew. But the ambition was to be a kind of rock songwriter, pop songwriter, wasn't it? To work in pop music.
Yes, it was. I made a sort of half-hearted attempt to sell my voice. I think I was, I didn't really have the sort of determination in that field as someone like Mick Jagger, who was, getting going at about the same time as me. And I'm talking before the Stones really made it big, and when I was first in London, and I'd be making a few tapes and sometimes going to sing with a couple of blues groups. And I wasn't terrible, but I wasn't great. And it was really because of that one of the I actually wrote three songs to illustrate my voice. I wrote the tunes as well, and they were very simple songs, but one of them was quite a good song, and it got recorded by an unknown group. And I had my feet on the bottom rung of the ladder, just because I'd had a record out. It wasn't a hit, but to get a record out in those days was something. Nowadays, anybody can make a triple album and stick it online.
Yes.
And unfortunately, and I therefore took this record to various people. I had an idea to do a book on pop singles, the history of, and I was a bit ahead of my time on that. And because in the end, we did it with the Guinness Book of Hit Singles, but that was a lot later. And I took this idea for this pop book to a book publisher who didn't think it was a good idea. He was wrong, and. But he did say he knew a young musician who was looking for someone to write words, and so that was Andrew, and I went round to meet Andrew, and we clicked. And what I didn't realize immediately was Andrew was really interested in theatre rather than rock, although he knew all about the Stones and the Beatles, and who were by that time very big. So and I knew enough about musicals to bluff my way through them. I mean, I hadn't seen many, but because I hadn't lived in London for long. But I knew all the great musicals, like, My Fair Lady, Oklahoma, South Pacific, because my parents had the albums, and I loved the songs. But it weirdly never gave me any incredible desire to see the show.
But then Andrew led you astray,
He led
away
me
from.
astray. I mean, in 1965, I went to see everything. A lot of very bad shows, I used to be there.
Well, I've watched
One
something.
or
I
two
mean,
good ones.
some of the shows that they put on in the 60s are not very good. I mean, there
Yeah,
was a lot of filler.
but that's true now.
Yeah, that's true now. Yeah, yeah,
I
yeah, yeah.
mean, look, it's in the pop world. One record in 10 or one show in 10 will be quite good, and about one in 50 will be a big hit. May not be quite as high as that, but when you think of all the and often really talented people who are putting shows together in Sheffield or Nottingham or places, and it's so much luck. You've got to be in the right place at the right time. And the key thing really is to have a good story. If you've got a good story, and Superstar was a good story, and Joseph was a good story, but Superstar was the one that got us off the ground, and it was different. And because we did it on record, that was different. And we were doing things not because we were brilliant, seers into the future, but because, that was the only progress we could make. If someone said, "I'll put Superstar on next week," it would have gone on and flopped, because it wasn't, it was rock, and it wouldn't have worked in a theatre without a rock band. But luckily, nobody said that, and we did it on an album, because a record company spotted it, and that led to everything. And
Well, exactly. I mean, it still looks revolutionary now to have done that and to do the Avicii concept album as well. To release those things before anyone had seen the stage version of it, and luckily, whetted enough appetites to make those huge successes. I guess looking back now, do you feel you've written for Elvis, you've written for Elton, you've written for, David Essex, you've written for some of the greatest pop and rock singers of the century. Do you feel that that side of you, that the teenage Tim Rice wanted to be the pop and rock star, kind of is fulfilled?
Well, I think it is. I mean, if you'd asked me that in 1965, I would have said, "Well, I would love to, have a number one hit single as a singer, or be in a band that had hits." But I would never have achieved what I've achieved in that area, even if I was lucky enough. And a lot of people, in those days, had a couple of hits and then disappeared, and they probably had a nice time while they did it, and I would have enjoyed that. But I honestly think it was. I mean, I would never have guessed what would have happened. And I mean, I've had a lot of great people sing my stuff. Streisand did, I know him so well, and Bing Crosby did one, and Elvis and Perry Como did a couple. I mean, my one regret is the Everly Brothers didn't. And even more annoyingly, they recorded a song of Andrews. The Everly Brothers were a huge influence on me, and indeed on the Beatles and lots of other people. And they've always been one of my absolute top favorite acts. And but I did get to know them both. I knew Don and Phil, and so that was great. But I'm sure that if they'd not been at war with each other half the time, they might have done a cover of something. You never know.
It's interesting. There can't be much that's left unfulfilled now, if thinking about you've got the EGOT, the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony, you've written a James Bond theme, you've written, I think, The Lion King. I think there's some statistic about The Lion King that it is the most profitable cultural product of all time, more than any.
That's what they say. I haven't noticed that in my royalty statements. But certainly the songs have done well. But no, they are talking. I don't know what I've no idea what the figures are, but it's billions of.
It's easily in the billions, yeah. But so there's there, is there anything left to tick off?
Well, not really. I mean, I'm still doing stuff, and you never know what. I mean, chess might take up, go whoosh, or it may just sink like a stone. I mean, there's enough to keep me occupied. I'm not burning with ambition, saying I've got to do something else. I do have a few ideas. I'm talking with one or two people about ideas for shows, but I've got to make sure I'm enthusiastic enough. I mean, I quite like staring into space and watching the cricket.
Well, speaking of which, the fourth day of the test has started about an hour ago, so I'm going to let you get back to it. But Tim, thank you so much for talking to me. It's been such a joy as ever, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Great pleasure. Thank you, Tim.
Theatre Voice is an archive of recorded interviews with theatre and performance practitioners. It's held in the V&A's Theatre and Performance Archives, the UK's national collection of performing arts, which are available to consult in the V&A's study rooms.